He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist.
Well, this is Steve Nurse, Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our second session interview with Joe Ulatowski. He is a brigadier general, or he's a retired brigadier general, and has been a career military person. We've been talking down our first session about his kind of pretty much remarkable life and in the military and all the things that he's done. It's kind of amazing sometimes, you know, when you look at a person and you think, I wonder where this person has been in his life. And boy, you don't have a clue, do you, really? Sometimes, because you look, I think you've been just about every place in the world that a person could possibly be. So let's talk about a little bit. I think we left off when you were going to school and you said you needed a college degree to move up in the military for the next step. And so you had an opportunity to do that, correct?
Right.
Okay. And so where did you go to the, where you said you went to, was it Columbia that you went to?
Columbia was one of the years. There were 4 years in the training program. The first year was in the Russian language at the Army Language School. The second was in Columbia in the graduate school there, where you learned about Russia from academia. And the third was to a recreated Russian school in Germany at the time, where you did everything in language and were taught by defectors from the Russian army in the various specialties that they were teaching.
Ah, so kind of firsthand knowledge there of the...
It was pretty much firsthand knowledge.
Yeah, and I imagine they talked to you about how the political system worked or didn't
work then? Well, we had a complete variety of instructors. We had civilians who served in the Russian government, one of whom was supposed to have served as in the Communist Party. We had a military instructor. We had a KGB instructor. We had a geographic and terrain instructors. All of these were Russians that had been exceedingly active before they had defected.
It's interesting. I know that even the Seattle School District has several language programs. I know they have one in Japanese. I know they have one in Spanish, where the kids, when you go into the school, and they do it when they're very young, because I guess you pick up language. But they, as a kindergartner, they go in and they speak, the teachers speak nothing but Japanese or Hispanic, Spanish. And I would think that's a real good way to learn. Was that interesting for you? I mean, it seems... I love history, and I love learning about...
Well, I always have been a history bluff, and it just added to it. No, it was extremely fascinating, and particularly when one knows, when one's going there, that you might be involved in it, and it's filling the need that you have. So, yeah.
And what did you do in... So then you went to Russia, and you were in
military attaché.
Military attaché in Russia, and what does a military attaché do? They carry their attaché around. Maybe that's not the question that I should.
Let's put it this way: we played cat tag with the KGB.
Uh huh. So they were.
No, a military attaché serves on the ambassador's staff on military affairs. I said military attaché. I was not the attaché. I was the junior attaché.
Uh huh.
As a captain at that time. And I worked for a very wonderful man who was a bird colonel.
And I think you told me when we talked before, he was one of the people you really enjoyed working for.
I heard stories before I went there, what a mean so-and-so he was, and how I would regret serving for him. And I found he was probably one of the most influential people on my life from there on out. He was the kind of a man who just gave you the job, and then it was your job, and if he could help you, he would help you. But he just gave it to you. It's yours. And as a result, we, in friendly countries, if you're looking for information, you go to the local attaché and say, hey, I hear you're building a new tank, or the local contact say, I hear you're building a new tank, so I'd like to see it.
Yes.
And after a cup of coffee and a fifth of bourbon, you go see it.
Uh-huh.
And in Russia, it was simply a quid pro quo to get people in the United States. And there were 13 of us, Army, Navy, and Air Force, to cover the entire Soviet Union. And you did it by what you saw.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's I just wanted to go back to this this colonel that you were talking about just a bit, because some of the things that we were talking about were, I think, just really good leadership kind of principles. In other words, I think one of the things you said was that, you know, he only wanted to see you, you know, a certain number of times. Number one, if you had a problem.
Okay, I can go through that.
I
thought that was one of the greatest leadership briefings I ever got.
It really stuck with me just the way, you know, you said it and everything. So,
pardon?
It really stuck with me the way you said it.
And yeah,
go ahead and go through that.
We got into Russia, and he said, come up to the office. The next morning, after we got a night's sleep, after our welcoming party, and he sat down and said, I will brief you on your job for the next couple of years. But here's where we start. I only want to see you 4 times in the next couple of years. The first time is when you need help, that you will come to me and tell me what help you need and give me 3 solutions as you see them, and then I will supplement with what I see you can do. The second time is when I need help. He, the colonel, needs help. And he will do the same thing to me. He would come to me, tell me what the problem is and what he thinks the solution is, and ask me for my thoughts. The third time is when you screw up, because you're going to screw up.
We all do.
He said, you are the one who walks in and tells me before anyone else. If you don't, I'll fire you. And the fourth time is when we have cocktails or dinner together, and I hope it's frequent. And that he lived by that. When he gave you a job, he sent you out, and you needed some help, he'd say, "Here I am, but it's your job. You do it, and I'll do what I can to supplement you." And he lived that too, which was just wonderful.
Yeah, I've had principals in when I was teaching school that kind of lived by that same, you know, I don't want to be bothered by every little thing, but if you do have a problem, I want to be the first to know about it.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to clean up everything afterwards and, you know, go through that. And was also the kind of principal that listened to us and supported us first. Wouldn't just listen to somebody else that was complaining about something that we had done, but, you know, got the real story.
Sure.
And, yeah. Is it somebody that you did you keep in contact with him after you left?
Well, we did for years. And
sure.
Then, unfortunately, he got called to the big roundup in the sky.
Okay, yeah, yeah. That happens to all of us, too, at some point, you know. But so then you were in, and how long were you in Russia? How many years?
2 years.
Okay. Was that, that wasn't during the time, who was the guy that was caught in Russia? He was flying a spy plane.
Power.
Yeah, right. Were you in there during that time at all? Or?
Well, I guess we were.
Yeah.
I mean, that was so closely held, nobody knew. We knew somebody was very skilled someplace, but we didn't know where.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that was top level.
And you felt like you were being watched pretty much all the time, right? I mean,
24 hours a day, if you could call it that. You just assumed your apartments were bugged, and so you never had what was known as free conversation. If you went out, you were always followed by at least 3 people, and sometimes if you were driving, you were followed by 3 cars.
Yeah, that's kind of like having your own attaché, but the KGB attaché. Yeah.
Well, some people just couldn't handle it. Some people just said, "That's all. I'm out."
I think it'd be pretty tough to have somebody kind of on your tail.
All the time?
All the time, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's like with my wife, you know, when I, after I retired, and I said, "Gee, I'll be around the house a lot more. I'll get to spend a lot more time with you." And she said, "No, you won't. You'll be out doing things."
We all go through it.
Yeah, that's for sure, yeah.
Was your wife with you in Russia?
Yes.
How did she react to all the observation?
She was wonderful. She was a full member of the group, and I couldn't have asked for more in a person.
Yeah.
Could not.
That's cool.
Yep, and I still feel that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still, yeah, and with my wife of 52 years, as she says, I'm still in training. So I did get my college degree, so, you know, unfortunately it wasn't in marriage, but, you know, as you said, we learn by experience in that situation.
Yeah.
So, and then after you got out of Russia, did you come back to the United States?
Came back to the United States, went to the...
And what year was that about?
That was 59.
Okay. And then were you stationed in the Pentagon or in D.C.?
No, I went back. I requested going back to the infantry again, and I ended up in the first battle group, the 10th Infantry Regiment in Fort Ord, California, and worked with them for about a year, and then got ordered to the Special Warfare Center at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And I spent there from guerrilla tactics instructor, or the buzzword back then was, and still is counterinsurgency. Is it Colonel Tactics Chief, Counterinsurgency Tactics Chief, and then Chief Instructor for the department? And
so what were you, you were teaching people how to kind of survive when they were out there, or?
No, it's the kind of tactics that you would use and how you integrated helicopters and how intelligence, the role that intelligence played, and what sort of tactics the people on the ground could be utilizing. And of course, the basic philosophy was that since I had done this in Korea, I had actual experience working with partisan groups.
Oh, that's right, because in Korea you said you worked with...
I worked with the
people on the resistance and some of those.
One of the key lessons when you start talking about these things, I didn't emphasize it earlier, but it is very true. You do not command a thing. And you have to realize when you're working with indigenous personnel, you don't command them. They have their own leaders. Their own leaders will command them. And this goes true all the way through. And unfortunately, in many cases, we Americans do not realize this. And we begin to think, oh, we're here, we're advisors, and therefore we have some element of command. The only element of command you have is either their personal motivation to do something, or because they're getting some sort of modern equipment, or somebody is paying them something. Depends on where the stage is in an insurgency and whether you are going to liberate the people or whether you're going to kind of quit in halfway.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that, we can't insert our culture in place of their culture. You have to be aware
no,
of the...
We can install our coaches, but they have no real authority.
Right.
They can just coach. What really happens is you're telling them what to tell their own people.
Right. So you're basically, so you may be teaching them how to use a weapon or to set a claymore or, something like that.
That, or you can tell them you want to blow up a railroad or something. You can't make them do it.
Right, right.
You can only suggest that that would be a good idea. Now,
were they good listeners? That's the question. And, of course, I'm assuming that the Americans have sometimes, some of these people were paid as to be in the military, or were they paid by the United States, or was any of that ever?
Oh, there's all sorts of...
Different levels.
I wouldn't even hesitate, because without knowing the actual situation,
you can't
do anything like that.
Yeah, yeah. And so...
But, Let me give you an example in the Korean War, because I think this is a perfect one. When we went in there and we were pushing the north there, whether it's in the mid-range, usually it would be afterwards when things sort of stabilized, but there is hope that you will be helping them liberate their country or throw them over their government, whatever you're helping them with.
So they're feeling good about it, or they're
feeling good. They're feeling patriotic. The minute it appears that you're talking peace, they realize they're not going to be going home. And that's where you undergo a change and life becomes rather dangerous. Because they begin to think, how do I get something out of this? I'm here, I have no country, I have nothing. You guys are talking about making peace. And this is where you start getting into, how do I buy my way back in? How do I get home again? I either want money, I want some sophisticated equipment, or maybe if I took you, that would buy me back. I had that tried against me one time.
So essentially getting kidnapped and...
What I'm saying is they need a bargaining chip to buy their way back in.
Right.
And whatever that bargaining chip is. Now, and some people don't. Some people just say, that's the way life is. And, you know, you start getting into all of the range of human emotions. And this is when we put our special forces or our counterinsurgency warriors working in these various countries. These are some of the things that they face, depending on the political situation as it's ongoing at the time.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, we also, you and I also talked about what's going on at the time. There's so many variables.
That's exactly right.
You know, what's going on at the time in their country and in their mind and with their relatives, and are they in the north? Are they in the south?
It's anywhere. It's any country in the world. When you start talking about this, you're dealing with particularly the special operations people. You're dealing with an entire panoply of human emotions. And it depends on what the individual motivation of an individual is, or a group of individuals is, as to what kind of results you're going to end with.
Did you see, you know, you work with different groups, you know, was there a lot of difference in, did you notice cultural differences when you worked, for instance?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's something we Americans do not fully appreciate, and I'm talking in more the military sense, that that, you know, so many thoughts are going through my mind in different circumstances.
Sure.
That even cultural levels between people can impact the way they think and believe. You go to India, for example.
With a caste system.
With a caste system. But not only that. You go from northern India to southern India, and an interpreter can't read the local signs. You go from east coast of Korea to the west coast of Korea. The cultural difference between them stands out. If you take a gorilla, you think you have a gorilla. He's a Korean. You get this gorilla, he goes to from the east coast to the west coast, and they think he'll blend in to our way of thinking. The minute he goes there, they can tell him instantly that he is not from that particular region.
Interesting.
It's like you could say in this country, that guy doesn't live in our neighborhood.
He lives in the south, or he lives in a different state.
Or whatever. No, I'm just talking about a neighborhood.
Sure.
You know who lives in that neighborhood. If a stranger walks in, your first question is, what's he doing here?
Yeah.
And so this is true culturally, and depending on the more isolated a population is, the more culturally different they are. So if you go working from here or from over there, you're going to have to readapt.
And I think not getting into politics at all, trying to, but I just think that sometimes as, you know, kind of a middle-aged, well, not middle-aged, I mean middle American, that I sometimes expect people to think like me, and and they don't. You know, I keep thinking of something like, well, if I was homeless, I would do A, B, C, or D. But not everybody is going to react like I do.
No,
and,
that's right.
And so we need to be aware of those. And I know that, you know, and we'll, in our next session, we'll talk about Vietnam. But I know that so many of these vets that I talk to would say, you know, you have small villages that with families. They may have 10, 20 families that live together for, you know, virtually their whole lifetime. And you go to the next village and it's a different culture. It's a different setup. It's a, you treat them entirely different. They may be, you know, they may be North Vietnam, you know, NVA people. They may be, you know, in favor of the democracy. I mean, it's just really interesting. So I'm sure even in Russia, when you were there, there was a different culture.
I mean, oh,
were people in Russia worried about? I mean, just the Russian people, were they worried about people following them around too, or was it? Just because you were American.
Oh, I think they would do it in a different way.
Right.
I think they would do it. Russia has a culture of self-informing outside of the family. And they have done that with people, and in fact, they're doing it today. It's, but you also have a compounding factor, because Russia, if you look at Russia, it is composed of totally different areas. And the areas within Russia are tribes that go back hundreds of years. The Bashkiris, the Dashkentis, the Georgians, they're not in Russia now, but they,
right.
But they were. All of these were tribes. Except for the core of Great Russians, that's the core group,
right?
And so they are—they've over the years have been manipulating one group or the other all the time, and it's a very different culture. And
I knew one of my graduate students is from Russia, one of the best students I've had. And her father was an instructor on the Olympic team, teaching the sword fighting. What's another? I mean, there's another
fencing.
Yeah. It wasn't building fences. It was, but he was, and somehow they kind of the family got the word that there was somebody that had some power that didn't like him. And they better get out of the country. And that's what they wound up doing. And, you know, so it there was kind of their own in system, you know. So why don't we go ahead and stop there for this one? And we'd like to do another session with you. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening to The Voice of Ashon and our series on military vets.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years.